Well, we're listening away today, Katona Whitlockville, with your hosts, Craig, Rich, and Dave. Some people claim that they're not that funny.
Well, what'd you expect?
They're not getting paid.
Welcome to Whitlockville, a Katona podcast. I'm joined by my hosts, Craig Johnson and Dave Becker. I'm Rich Knopke, of course. We've got a very special podcast for you tonight. We're going to learn a little bit about the history of Katona, the origins of it, with our good friend Don Coe. He'll be joining us momentarily. In the meantime, Dave, do we have a sponsor?
We do have a sponsor, and I'm excited about this one. The sponsor is... Oh, wait, sorry, we just had a brownout. I apologize. That's been happening quite frequently in Katona recently, so you may have caught it, you may not have, but Rich, I'll throw it back to you. Thanks.
Well, thank you for that. I don't even know where to go with that one. You caught me on that one. I thought you just had your brain, the synapses weren't firing.
Well, that's the typical state of affairs, so yeah. I could see how you
that was
think
just
that.
The electricity.
Exactly.
I get it. Well, it's been a couple of weeks since we've done one of these. Good to see you again. Good to be recording.
You too. You're looking nice and tan.
Thank you.
Maybe slightly burnt.
Maybe.
Well, it's also good to see you in color, because I've recently seen you in black and white.
In the newspaper.
Newspaper.
We are...
Multimedia.
That's really fantastic. Very exciting to have been featured in the Record Review over the last Friday. It was great. We were bumped off the front page. What was on the front page? Go back to the front page for a second. This is what I wanted to say. We should have been on the front page, but there were safety concerns over herbicide use on our roads. So that took was greater precedence than us. And what else?
There was also the Poundridge family that embarked on a journey into solar.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, that's definitely more important than us, I think. Anyway, we're incredibly flattered to have been featured. Great article. They brought out the big guns for the interview. It was a second year intern at the paper, so she was quite wonderful.
Asked
a bunch of great questions, and we asked her at the end of the podcast. She said that her editor in chief had found the podcast, so thank you for that. We asked her what she thought of the podcast, and she said pleasantly surprised is what she said, which is what my wife said after our first date. I'm like, how was that? She's like, I was pleasantly surprised. So this was really great. And we couldn't, of course, we couldn't have done this without the great people who have been on our podcast so far, and all the people listening out there. So thank you very much.
It's a great picture. Apparently I was, you were making me laugh.
It's a hearty one for you.
My sister asked about it this weekend. She's like, how tall is that guy? And I said, originally I wanted to call the podcast Two Jews and a Giant. So I'm glad we came
two
up
youths?
With two yes. I'm glad we came up with Whitlockville, which we'll find out in a little bit if Whitlockville is really the correct name for the actual podcast. I do want to say, before we get into that, I did read an article on Newsweek. I just wanted to get your take on this. There was a Bronx woman, so it's semi-local. Bronx woman was celebrating her 107th birthday, and do you want to know what her secret to her long life was?
Of course.
Is staying single. She said staying single was it, not never getting married, and she said, I think that's the secret. My sister says, I wish I never got married. Her sister.
How old's her sister?
Her sister is still alive at 102, by the way. Ironically, numerous studies have suggested that single people actually die younger than their married counterparts. Men especially die younger without being married. Some of that is because if you're a couple, one of the quotes in here says, if you're a couple, a spouse may be after you to eat better and go to the doctor. Do you get that? Do you get that at home? Like just the eating better thing and going to the doctors, or you're not sure?
Well, certainly eating better.
No question about it.
And with Elena's Gourmet Globetrotter extra, and what she's been doing for Bedford 2020, it comes up all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, tonight, like, for instance, I would have loved to have gone out for a nice steak, but I had a salad instead.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have done that on your own.
No.
If Rhee weren't here, you
no,
would be...
No, it was Rhee's decision.
Yeah, of course. I don't... I get, of course, same thing, you know, Jess is always cooking healthy meals. And like this morning and yesterday morning, we were away, we were at a bed and breakfast with the whole family. And they had a bunch of different breakfasts there. And I had, according to Jess's count, because she was counting, I had 4 breakfasts this morning and yesterday morning. and she is not shy to tell me that. But what she'll do is she'll look at ingredients on package. She won't say anything. She'll be like, can I see that box? Whatever. And she'll look at the ingredients and just look at me and then just put it down and be like, she'll just shake her head. So you could totally see, you know, how, you know, men especially will live a little bit longer.
If left to my own devices, I think I would eat King Cone maybe 15 of 21 meals per week. Fried alligator, right, the flurry. I mean, there's some options there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's different ways you can go.
One of the other people mentioned in this article, 106-year-old Edith Wiley told Montana's Great Falls Tribune, I imagine we're going to get interviewed by the Great Falls Tribune next for an article there. She said her long life is due to, you'll like this, Dave, bourbon, water, and Cheetos.
Substitute Doritos for Cheetos, and she just described
right.
Like
bourbon and King Cone. That would be like yeah, that's right. Like your thing.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
I don't know if you lived to 106 with that. She's very lucky.
I wonder if they did a study of all these studies, which ones would repeat themselves. Right. You have someone who's saying the key to long life is being single. Another one is bourbon and
Cheetos.
The next one's going to be, you know, I eat bacon every day. Someone is, I don't eat bacon
They do
all.
That, you know, or like George Burns had a cigar every day.
Cigar at
the
time.
You know, and he lived to, did he get 100? He hit 100, right? Ish?
I think it comes down to genetics.
Yeah.
It comes down to genetics and everything else gets backfilled.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, I had a shot of whiskey every day. Well, you could because your genetics.
Yeah.
About that.
Yeah, and there are people who are, you know, perfectly healthy and whatever, and, you know, they're not as lucky.
Right.
So it's really interesting. One more. This woman in Italy, the oldest verified person on Earth when she died at 117 in 2017, gave credit to a particularly odd dietary habit. She had 3 eggs a day, 2 of which were eaten raw. Which, as we call it, that's the Rocky Balboa diet.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he did that in the first Rocky. So I don't know. Did you? I don't know if you.
So I just checked with our crack staff that we have in the
our
back.
Our
research staff. He lived to 100.
He did.
He got right at the number.
Yeah.
Right.
Cigars, number. And I think he started smoking them at like age 4. So. Anyway, we're gonna take it away. We're gonna have Craig here introduce Don, and we're gonna go from there. So thank you very much.
I am pleased and honored to introduce a friend of mine, and a longstanding Katona historian, Donald Coe. Don, I'm gonna provide our listeners with a brief bio, and then we'll jump into hearing the story of our wonderful town. I won't give your age away, Don, but I will say that I understand that you and your wife, Margie, have lived in Katona for 62 years, where you raised 2 children who, among other things, attended KES. Don has been an educator here in Westchester County for his entire career, except for 2 years when he faithfully and honorably served his country in the Korean War as a platoon leader in the 31st Infantry. In that role, Don led men during the famous Battle of Porkchop Hill, where he was wounded and decorated with the Purple Heart. We couldn't be more honored to have you on our podcast, Don. So without further ado, let's jump right into some questions. Now, as you know, we named our podcast Whitlockville in a nod to the original Katona. But I understand that we may have gotten that wrong. Please tell us that that's not the case.
Well, the Katona is aptly described by some as a wandering village. It was originally settled in shortly after the whole of Bedford was bought from the Indians in 1680. A fellow by the name of Jacobus Van Cortlandt, whose Van Cortlandt house is open to view over in Croton, bought a whole section of land from the Indians, and he sold some of it off to basically farmers who were really fairly basic subsistence farmers who lived on the old Muscoda Trail, mm-hmm. which we now call Cherry Street, up along the top of the ridge in the back of Katona. The purchase was made by a sachem by the name or a headman of the Indian tribe, and his name was Katona. And one of the interesting things about Chief Katona is a story which is probably true, but the story is that Chief Katona, this is before the land sales, of course, but Chief Katona was out hunting in the during the time that he was away, there was a severe thunderstorm with lightning, and you know we usually get these and frequently get these in the summertime, and one of the lightning bolts hit a tree and knocked it over, and it fell on the wigwam or longhouse, whatever it was, that Chief Katona lived in, and his wife and baby were there, and they were both killed. And the story is that Katona came home, opened the door, and saw what had happened, and immediately died, probably of some sort of a heart attack. So this is all a lead-in into answering your question about Whitlockville. Our first settlement was not Whitlockville. Our first settlement was Cherry Street, up along the top of the hill.
Now, Don, I had relied on my friend Rich Knopke here to do that research, and he told me that the first town was Whitlockville. So, Rich, I'm laying this at your feet.
You would think I did any sort of research. I don't think I did. I don't know where I got that from.
What happened next was, this was in the 1600s, late. And
my research didn't go back that far.
Got it.
I think that's what it was.
In the date is not particularly clear, but at a later date, there was a man by the name of Mr. Whitlock, mm-hmm. and there was this little. Now remember, Cherry Street is up on top of a hill,
right?
And at the bottom of the hill, there was a little stream. Running through the valley, and he conceived of building a dam and building a mill down there. His name was Mr. Whitlock, and so he ate ground grain, mm-hmm. he sawed wood using the power from this dam. He also made a beautiful little lake that came up backed up, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So our second location was Whitlockville, because people moved there. They were going to work for Mr. Whitlock. The bottom land was good, rich soil. And so Whitlockville is now out under some 22 feet of water, where the after the dam was after the Muscoo Dam was built, so Whitlockville eventually just disappeared under the waters when the much later dam was built. So that's the second wandering, Cherry Street, Whitlockville. So then in 1847, the New York Central Railroad decided to build 1840, they decided to build north from New York City. They wanted to connect to the wider world. And so in 1847, the railroad reached Whitlockville, and a little town was formed around it, which was originally called Whitlockville Station. But it was about 3/4 of a mile from Whitlockville, and everything was going on up at the station, and not much was going on in Whitlockville. And so some people actually moved their houses from Whitlockville up to where around the railroad station, and other people built new houses there. And there was a community of 500-800 people right in that area around what had been called Whitlockville Station, but then was renamed Katona in honor of the sachem, or the Indian chief that had sold the lands originally. Well, this is a wonderful little village, sort of like what you were telling about that you liked about Katona today. It was a big deal was the summer, because summer is very hot in New York City, and it's not that much cooler up here, but it was cooler up here, and people would come up, and it got a name as a summer boarding place, and there were boarding houses and croquet on the lawns and all sorts of things through the 1830s through 1880s in Katona.
And Don, to interrupt you there for a second, was it the train that made that possible?
Oh, yes.
The train line?
Yeah. And the train line, incidentally, continued. It went to Croton Falls. Right now it goes only as far as Wasaic. But as I mentioned, it was the first train line built north from New York City, way before the Hudson Line. And it went all the way up to Chatham, New York, and then joined with other railroads, notably the Boston and Albany, but also lines that went up through Vermont. And it really connected New York City with the world, and indirectly it connected Katona too.
And was the rail line at that point used for pleasure purposes, commercial purposes, or both?
Oh, yeah. We weren't into a travel era as we are now.
Mm-hmm.
People would do more local travel, but everything traveled on the railroad in those days. For example, many of the houses in New Katona, now I'm going ahead of myself because I'm only on the third.
Got it.
The third one. Right? But many of the houses in New Katona were built from a Sears Roebuck kit that you bought off the big catalog. You ordered it. It came on the railroad. They took it to your house on a horse and wagon, and you assembled it or had other people assemble it. So and there were hotels in old Katona. And then a really strange thing happened. There had been a small dam along the Croton River, which runs as you go north out of Katona and Woodsbridge Road. Woodsbridge goes over the former bed of the Katona, of the Croton River. There was a small dam further down, about 4 or 5 miles, but New York City decided they needed more water, and so they decided to build a big dam, a huge dam, at Croton. And that's a wonderful day trip, incidentally, to see the dam, which is still extant and which still is able to supply water to New York City. When they did that, there was a concern that the water level would go up and down. And if the water level in New Katona, because I'm getting into that now, went up and down, then that would cause mud flats, that would cause mosquitoes, all sorts of other ugly, ugly things. So a dam called the Muscoot Dam was built. And when you go over the bridge, Woods Bridge, mm-hmm. to the north of Katona, and you look to the west, which is, if you're going north, it's to the left, you'll see a straight line across between two steep hills. That is the Muscoot Dam. And that guarantees that the water level in the reservoir area around Katona, which is called the Muscoot Reservoir, mm-hmm. will always stay constant and not be a problem. Well, I'm talking all of this about the dam because that caused a problem for Katona. In the summer of 1893, a gentleman stood on the bridge in downtown Katona and said, "We're condemning all of this land. We have the right. We are New York City. We do. We have the legal right to condemn all of these properties." Their concern was that what they were using for soil, body soils, is what I'm talking about, was mostly cesspools, and cesspools. Water drains downhill, mm-hmm. and they didn't want the cesspool draining into their brilliant new reservoir system. And so they condemned an enormous amount of land, much of which, incidentally, is still above water, because the water level was only going to come up 22 feet. So New York City condemned the village, and what to do? The people really had a sense, as they do today, of friendship, of united together. They really wanted to stay together. So a farm was bought, the other side, about 3/4 of a mile away from Old Katona. A farm was bought, the land was subdivided, and laid out by a not-so-famous B.S. and G.S. B.S. and G.S. Olmsted. They are not, to my information, and the information in the Katona book, they are not the Olmsted that built Central Park. And nobody knows much about the Olmsted brothers, but they laid out a beautiful layout of the town. And if you look at a subdivision map of the town, you can see that it is laid out with a strong vertical, with an esplanade fashion, with trees in the center, and then there is a cross, which we call the Parkway, which runs in front of the library and Kellogg's and Lawrence, etc. Now, and then there is a circle with a flagpole in the center. That is essentially a Celtic cross. This group of people in Old Katona were very church-oriented. There were three churches. There was St. Mary's Church, up on top of the hill. There was the Presbyterian Church across from this little pond that I was talking about that the mill backed up. And the Methodist Church with a tremendous spire was built right next to the Presbyterian Church on what was aptly called Church Avenue. Church Street, I'm sorry, I missed them. So this idea of the Katona Land Company to lay it out as a Celtic cross was really very brilliant, because it embodies many of the things that today we take as good corporate or town planning principles. I served some time on the planning board in the town of Bedford, so I'm aware of some of these sorts of things. So, the land company was formed, and people bought plots of land. And incidentally, in the library, there are maps. In the Katona Museum upstairs, there are maps of both old Katona and new Katona, and there are numbers of on both maps. Number 30 is the location on the old map, mm-hmm. where that house was moved from old Katona to where number 30 is on the subdivision map of new Katona.
And how many houses were moved?
Well, a total of 55 buildings were moved. Not only houses, but also Charles Department Store, which is no tiny building, three stories, and they were all moved. Incidentally, we're not talking here about the diesel age or the gasoline age or even the electric age. We are talking about when the force that moved things was the horse. So what they did, they would take a house, and of course the beautiful example of that is the Chapman House, mm-hmm. which you can see on the terrace. And in the library there are some beautiful, huge photographs of the Chapman House being moved. The Chapman House is a good example of how they did it. The Chapman House was on a hill, and they built up pieces of wood stacked sideways and tried to make similar to a railroad track, but a track of southern pine wood. Now you may ask, why did they use southern pine rather than northern pine? Northern pine is very brittle, mm-hmm. and it breaks easily. Southern pine is very lithe and will give and take. And you're talking about, when you're talking about the Chapman, you're talking about 200 or 300 tons, not a small amount to be reckoned with.
How far did they move it?
Chapman House moved about 3/4 of a mile.
Okay.
Not only did the Chapman House move on these skids that I'm talking about, it had to come down a hill, it had to cross the little river that's there, the Cross River, it had to go up a hill, and then it had to continue on down the main street for a long way, then it had to go up another hill, and then they
had... So that's a rough 3/4 of a mile. Yeah. It's a straight shot.
Yeah.
And I read somewhere...
Let me just finish with it, because then it was headed south, and it had to be turned some way or another. I don't know how they did that. But turned so that it faced east and west, and then they backed it into the property. And it is there today, and a beautiful piece. The odd thing about it also, the houses in those days did not have wallboard like we have, which is fairly strong stuff. I've been able to break it, but every house was made with lath and plaster. And you can imagine, after having been moved 3/4 of a mile, how much of the plaster was in good shape, even though it had wallpaper over it. I'm sorry you asked
that. No. I read this on the internet, so it must be true, just like the name of the podcast. Did they use laundry soap? They greased tracks with laundry soap?
Yes, laundry soap.
That's amazing.
Was much better than the grease, because if it rained, the laundry soap got even smoother, and it lasted longer.
Yeah.
So, but it was a complicated move, and the way that it moved was it was pulled by ropes, excuse me, which were tied to the house, and then the rope would come out, and they would drive a big stake in the ground. And then they would take a piece of log, maybe 2 feet, 3 feet across, and they would drill a hole in the bottom, and they would drill a hole in the side. The hole in the bottom they would slide this log over the stake. Then the hole in the side, they would stick a pole in. Then on the end of the stick, the long pole that came out, they would tie the horse, and the rope was tied to the, this is called a windlass system, the rope was tied to the post in the ground, to the log in the ground, and the horse would walk around. And as he walked around, he would tighten the rope, and the house would move.
That's crazy.
And you might go off in the morning, because people lived in their houses, and you might go off in the morning or go to school in the morning, and you'd come home, and your house is not where it was this morning. It is 30 feet, 60 feet.
That's really
feet
fantastic.
Down the rope.
How long did it take to move the houses?
Quite a while. I have no idea. It must have, in some cases, been months. Probably something like the Chapman House, which is the one I was talking
months.
About.
Months, okay.
Yes. Incidentally, in the basement by the children's room of the library, there's a beautiful scale model that somebody has built of the Chapman House with the windlass out in front and showing how it was moved. And, of course, being Yankees, they did not want to waste those fences that they'd put up. So they would bring those along on the front porch, and they would hang their clothes out because life went on. I don't know how they got water, but other facilities that we might wish to have. So that was really a very complicated way to move 55 buildings from Old Katona to the new. And on this map that I'm talking about, the subdivision of Old Katona and New Katona map, those you can tell where they came from and tell who they were owned by, all sorts of information that is in the Katona book, which I'll talk about at the end. Okay, so obviously we've been through three different wanderings. The first one, Cherry Street, Whitlockville, Old Katona, and now we're in New Katona.
What was the name of the town that you thought it was again?
So I'd read something, there was a name Mechanicville.
Mechanicville was the first name of Whitlockville. And then Mr. Whitlock had some political power in the town, and so it was called, for some reason or another, Whitlockville. But Mechanicville was at one stage, yes.
That's why we named it Whitlockville.
Exactly.
The political clout that Mr. Whitlock had over seemingly far reaches into the future with this podcast.
Or Mr. Knopke over Mr. Becker, considering Mr. Becker brought the name to the group, but Mr. Knopke shut it down for Whitlock.
Did you, or did you bring it up on the first podcast? I can't remember.
Good point.
We had already previewed it.
Okay. So, the train started stopping in 1897. It started stopping in New Katona.
Mm-hmm.
And New Katona soon developed the other the amenities that they had in Old Katona, because every person selling shoes to Arnold's Shoe Store or hardware to Kellogg's and Mead, which is now Kellogg's and Lawrence, all of these people traveled by train, because if you were going to go by horse and shay or horse and carriage to Mount Kisco, it was probably 3/4 of an hour or an hour. The train would get you there in 7 minutes, but the other means were much slower. So the town developed right across on the corner where there is now a real estate agency. There was a hotel right across from the railroad station, which incidentally was not the first railroad station in New Katona, or in present Katona. There was one that was later moved up and became the freight station up. You know where those big red brick buildings are on both sides of the road? When Marty and I moved here in 1958, well, I came in 58, she came 57, there were big oil tanks there, and there were rail tracks for storage of flat cars and oil cars and all that sort of stuff.
So that beautiful area downtown was once an oil depot.
Well, once an oil depot, one of the uglier ones, in my opinion. H.H. Park, good man, but he didn't store his oil. Across the street, there was a big gas station in the late 1950s, occupying all the land from where the Blue Dolphin is, all the way up to the big building on the corner, which was H.H. Park's office and repair shop. So that whole end of Cotonou has changed a great deal since the 1950s. But I'm back in 1897, when the railroads first stopped at New Cotonou. There were not only the 55 buildings that were moved, which were houses here and there, and commercial buildings along the main street. There was a lot of undeveloped land, and some people started to build new facilities. For example, the one on the corner that I talked about that was the hotel was built in New Cotonou. Across the street where KR was, the KR restaurant, that was Hoyt's department store and from Old Cotonou, and he built that three-story building. Mr. Hoyt also sold furniture, and as he had done in Old Cotonou, furniture makers could also make caskets, and so there was a need in any town for a funeral service, and he filled that niche. That passed through two or three other hands, and now is Clark's Funeral Home, the direct descendant of Mr. Hoyt's building on the corner.
So there's a lot of continuity in the town.
Oh yeah.
Some of the families that are in town, some of the name stores, they've been here for generations.
Now Kellogg's and Lawrence is a good. I mentioned earlier that it was called, when it was built, it was called Kellogg's and Mead. Mr. Mead sold out to Mr. Lawrence, and that store was built, a three-story building, and as a matter of fact, the Methodists, Kellogg's were Methodists, the Methodists used to meet until their new building was built in 1901. They used to meet on the top floor of what is now Kellogg's and Lawrence. And another interesting thing about that is back in those days, the Postal Service was very politicized. And when the Democrats were in power, I think I've got this right, when the Democrats were in power, the postal boxes were in the window at Kellogg's and Lawrence. So you could walk by and look in box 203 and you would know whether you had any mail. Anybody else would know whether you had any mail. However, when the Republicans were in power, then it went across the street. They took them out of the window at Kellogg's and Lawrence and took them across the street and put them in Mr. Arnold's shoe store window. And so you could look in box 203 and still see whether you had mail, or anybody else could also. I don't know, that small town stuff. What happened in Old Cotonou was the land was condemned, but the buildings were not condemned. And so New York City had absolutely no interest in the buildings. They didn't want to burn them all up. And these people had this intense wish to stay together as an extended family, like they'd been for many, many years. So, where was I going with this? So New York City decided to auction off the buildings. And if you go to the second floor of the library, there's a little museum there, the Cadona History Museum. And up on the wall are some posters advertising what's for sale, what buildings are for sale, the address. And so there would be 100 people show up for an auction of your house. People were very accommodating. If Margie and I wanted to keep our house, nobody would bid against us. So we'd buy our house back for $20.
I feel like Craig would have done that. He would have been against you.
But, you seem like now, that kind of guy. Craig has a young family, now that you mention him, and he might like a bigger house, maybe a four-bedroom house.
See?
And so... And you, meanwhile, have a large family, too. And you might like the same place. And so the two of you would bid it. And it might get up to $50 for a three or four.
That's bedroom. Too rich for my blood. You can have it. Forget it.
On the other hand, you could buy a privy. But because that was the, you know, we still don't have sewers in downtown Cadona, New Cadona.
Yeah.
You could buy those for $1. But you could also buy a nice barn. And as you went around town, you still see some old barn. And they would go for $10-$15. Most of them were disassembled and carried down sort of as lumber. The odd thing was that the churches, remember I said there were three churches in Old Cadona. There was the St. Mary's Church. St. Mary's, they took to pieces, and they brought the pieces down and reassembled them on the site over here, and that is the front of St. Mary's Church. Later on, the congregation grew as the town grew, and they added a piece going, lengthened the nave. And the second church was the Methodist Church, and that was built in in the 1880s. I mean, these places were almost new when it came time to get rid of them, as was the Presbyterian Church. And just before, as a matter of fact, just before the announcement was made in 1893 that everything was condemned, they had built a big extension and put in a new organ into the church because of the Presbyterian Church growing. So the Methodist Church was taken apart and sold for lumber. The Presbyterian Church, both of them knew, were taken apart and sold for lumber. And they had to move. They had to get out. So I mentioned that in New Cadona, the Methodists, while they were building their building of cobbles at the north end of Cadona, they met on the top of Kellogg's, what is now Kellogg's and Lawrence. Presbyterians, they built a brown-like structure right on the property next to where the existing church is. And they held their services in there until their new church was ready. It was, I think, 1901 or 1902. So there was quite a while they worshipped in that barn-like structure.
What I am taking away from this is the indomitable spirit of the people in this town.
Yeah.
And how much there is to be proud of when faced with that choice in 1893. I mean, could you ever imagine going through that?
Yeah, I mean, of course. We're, you know, that's what the Nopkies are all about. that's our thing. That really is our thing. It really is amazing, and this might be a good way to end part one, maybe. I think we'd love to come back another time and get a little bit more of the history and the spirit of the town.
There is a couple of things I want to say, though. One is that I did not make up all this stuff.
Unlike us.
And that available in the library is a book entitled Katona, The History of a New York Village and Its People. And it was written by Francis R. Duncombe back in the 1960s. And it is still available for sale in the library. A companion volume to that, also written by Francis Duncombe, is a book called Cassie's Village, which is a fictional story about a teenage girl, which is great for reading from kids. Also, one of the people when I moved here I met was a woman by the name of Boo Kelly. Her son, Ed Kelly, still runs a contracting company in the village. But Boo was a great resource. She was a descendant of many of the families in town. And Boo did, in the back of that Katona history book that I just talked about, she did genealogies and biographies of the main people in Old Katona and New Katona. And it is fascinating. Some of them are still around. Some of them have, of course, passed as far as being families. But
And one last thing before we let you go, Don. You had mentioned the museum.
Yes.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about the museum and what other resources are available to people who want to learn more about the history of the town?
Well, the museum is on the second floor of the Katona Library. It's curated really by Deirdre Courtney Batson, who is sort of the official or unofficial town historian. And a lot of us work up there. It's frequently open on Saturday afternoon, and there's a lot of good stuff up there, including a lot of pictures. They require somebody to say, well, this is blah, and this the other one. The thing I feel about the move, because I know you're talking about winding up, is that the move is a real symbol of Katona's heritage. The strength and determination of the villagers to stay together fostered a sense of community that still exists today in spite of the village's change from an agricultural, which it was, to a bedroom commuter-based community. Thank you for asking me.
Don, thank you so much.
Thank you, Don.
This is
really
what
wonderful.
You wanted?
This is great. This is perfect. And,
this is great.
And we'll wrap up by with a couple things. First of all, that same sense of community that you talk about that's been prevalent since the very beginning here, we do something called the Katonan of the pod. So like the people who are doing something wonderful in their life or the community or mm-hmm. something of that nature. That same spirit is our Katonan of the pod. This week is Rob Cummings and the amazing volunteers working on the John Jay Community Trail behind the high school and middle school. I'm certainly not going to be able to give them justice and the proper credit due to all the people who have been working on this trail, volunteering both their time and money. People they're accepting donations to work the trails, the 5K trail, I think it's 5K, behind the schools. And they've been putting up board work and creating that trail for many, many months now. And so for that, Rob and the huge team of volunteers there are Katonans of the pod.
Thank you, Rob.
There is one other thing I want to mention. I skipped over it. There has been a very strong group within the town, which is probably responsible for a lot of this sense of community, and that is the Katona Village Improvement Society, which I should have mentioned. They've fomented the library, the swimming pool, all sorts of different things.
We were actually going to mention them anyway, because we know the Katona Village Improvement Society 5K and Children's Mile race is coming up on September 7th.
Oh.
So okay. We also wanted to make sure that we got that out there. That's a really fun event. Again, celebrates the spirit of the community, spirit of Katona. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. And so with that said, thanks again for listening to Cherry Street, a Katona podcast. I've got a new ending, by the way.
Let's hear it.
And so the last one was Chief Katona says Shalom. That got nixed in my family. They didn't like that. So we were workshopping this at home. So until the next time, think globally, act Katonally.
That's very good.
Anyway, thanks for listening. Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Don.
Very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Well, we're listening away to Jay Katona Whitlockville with your hosts, Craig, Rich, and Dave. Some people claim that they're not that funny.
Well, what'd you expect?
They're not getting paid.